refuge. The birds nest on the high ledges, and at morning and evening, the bats fly out and in through the few broken windows. It will remain a long time, a very long time. He turned south on Broadway, thinking to follow it clear to the Battery. At 170th Street, however, he came to a very official-looking street-closed sign with an arrow directing him to detour eastward. He could have driven past the sign and ahead, but he felt a caprice to yield docilely to instructions. He drove over to Amsterdam Avenue and then went south again. His nostrils let him know that the medical center must have been one of the last points of concentration, and that the detour sign had been put up to give directions around it. Amsterdam Avenue was vacant, too. Somewhere in these vast accumulations of concrete and brick and mortar and plaster, somewhere in all these cave-like holes that men called rooms, somewhere, certainly, some people must be living. The catastrophe had been nearly universal, and in overcrowded Manhattan, the disease had probably raged even more severely than elsewhere. Also, he thought, what he had come to call the secondary kill might have been more severe in a wholly urbanized population. Nevertheless, he had already learned that a few people had survived elsewhere, and surely among the millions of Manhattan, there would be some. But he did not bother to blow his horn. A mere straggler here and there he had found to be of little interest to him now. He drove on, block after block. Everything was quiet and motionless. The clouds had broken, and the sun stood high overhead. But the sidewalks were as empty as if the sun had been the moon, and the hour had been 3 in the morning. Even then, he would have seen a beat-walking policeman, or have met a Nighthawk cab. He passed an empty playground. A few cars were parked along the curbs. He remembered that his father had driven him through downtown Manhattan on a Sunday when even Wall Street lay deserted. This was much the same, but worse. At last, near Louisiana Stadium, nuzzling around an entryway, two thin-looking dogs supplied the first sign of life. In the next block, he saw a few pigeons fluttering about. Not many. He drove on, past the red brick buildings of Columbia University, and stopped in front of the high, still unfinished cathedral. It was unfinished now, and so it would remain. He pushed at the door, it swung open, he entered. Momentarily, he had a horrible thought that he might find the nave piled with the bodies of those who at the last hour had gathered there to pray. But there was no one. He walked down a side aisle and went into the little chapels of the apse, one after another. Those where the English and the French and the Italians and all the others of that teeming polyglot city had been invited to kneel and worship. The sunlight streamed in at the stained glass windows. It was all as beautiful as he remembered from before. He had a wild desire to throw himself on his knees before one of the altars. There are no atheists in foxholes, he remembered. But the whole world now was nothing but a huge foxhole. But certainly what had happened did not inspire one to think that God was particularly interested in the human race or in its individuals. He walked back along the main aisle. Turning, he looked up the nave and let its grandeur beat in upon him. He felt a little choking in the throat. This, then, was the end of all man's highest striving and aspiration. He went out to the empty street and got into the car again. At Cathedral Parkway, he swung east and, defying traffic signs, entered Central Park and went south along the East Drive, thinking that on a summer day, people might go to the park, as they would have done ordinarily. But he saw no one. From his previous visit as a boy, he remembered squirrels. But he saw no squirrels either. Starving dogs and cats had apparently accounted for them already. On a meadow, he saw a bison bull grazing, not far off a horse. He passed the back of the Metropolitan Museum and saw Cleopatra's Needle, now doubly orphaned. At Sherman's statue, he swung into Fifth Avenue, and a tag end of verse popped into his mind. Now, all your victories are in vain. An island within an island. The green oblong of the park will remain. It has open soil where the rain penetrates. The sun shines upon it. In the first season, the grass grows tall. The seeds fall from the trees and bushes. The birds bring in more seeds. Give it two seasons, three seasons, and the eager saplings are sprouting. Give it 20 years, and it is a jungle of second growth, with each tree straining upward to gain light above its fellows, and the hardy natives, fast-growing ash and maple, crowding out the soft exotics which man once planted there. You hardly see the bridle path anymore. Leaf litter lies thick on the narrow roads. Give it 100 years, and you walk in full-grown forest, scarcely knowing that man was ever there, except where the stone arch still spans the underpass, making a strange cave. The doe walks in the woods, and the wildcat leaps upon the rabbit, and the bass jumps in the lake. In the tall windows of the fashion shops, the mannequins still postured strangely in gay costumes, their jewelry flashing. But Fifth Avenue lay before him empty, as quiet as Main Street of Podunk on a Sunday morning. The windows of one great jewelry store had been smashed. I hope, thought Ish, he found the diamonds good eating, poor guy. No, I hope he was somebody who liked pretty stones because they were pretty, like a child picking them up on the beach. Perhaps with his diamonds and rubies, he really died happier. On the whole, however, there was little disturbance along Fifth Avenue. The corpse is laid out in good condition, he thought. Yes, Fifth Avenue makes a beautiful corpse. A few pigeons fluttered up at Rockefeller Center, disturbed now by the sound of a single motor. At 42nd Street, yielding to a whim, he stopped the car in the middle of Fifth Avenue and got out, leaving Princess shut up. He walked east on 42nd Street, the empty sidewalk ridiculously wide. He entered Grand Central Terminal and looked in at the vast expanse of waiting room. "War!" he called loudly, and felt a childlike pleasure as an echo came reverberating back from the high vault through the emptiness. He wandered back to the street, and a revolving door caught his eye. He pushed against it idly and found himself in the lobby of a large hotel. Flanked by huge chairs and davenports, the lobby led on to the desk. Standing just inside the door, he had a moment's idea of approaching the desk and entering into an imaginary conversation with the reservation clerk. He had telegraphed from, well, Kansas City would be a good place. Yes, and his reservation had been confirmed. What were all these excuses now? But the insane notion faded. With 1,000 rooms empty and the poor clerk gone, who knew where, the joke was not very funny. At the same time, also, he noticed something different. Over all the chairs and davenports and cigarette stands and marble floors lay a distinct layer of gray dust. Perhaps not being a housekeeper, he had not previously noticed dust, or perhaps this place was particularly dusty. No matter which, from now on, dust would be a part of his life. Back at the car, he slipped it into gear, crossed 42nd Street, and continued south. On the steps of the library, he saw a gray cat crouched, paws stretched out in front, as if in caricature of the stone lions above. At the Flatiron Building, he turned into Broadway and followed it clear to Wall Street. There they both got out, and Princess showed interest in some kind of trail which ran along the sidewalk. Wall Street. He enjoyed walking along its empty length. With a little observation, he discovered that there was some grass, weeds rather, showing green here and there in the cracks of the gutter. He remembered the family story that an early Dutch settler, one of their ancestors, had owned a good farm in this vicinity. His father, when the bills were high, used to say, "Well, I wish we had held on to that farm on Manhattan Island." Now Ish could take the land back for all that anybody cared. Yet this wilderness of concrete and steel and asphalt was the last place where anybody would really care to live now. He would trade that Wall Street farm for any 10 acres in Napa Valley, or even for a small corner of Central Park. He walked back to his car and drove south on Broadway still, the little distance to the Battery. There he gazed across the expanse of the lower bay toward the ocean. This was the end of the road. There might be communities left in Europe or South America or on some of the islands, but he could not go to find out. Right here, doubtless, his Dutch ancestor had come ashore some 300 years ago. Now he, Ish, had rounded the full circle. He noticed the Statue of Liberty. Liberty, he thought ironically. At least I have that. More than anyone ever thought of when they put the lady up there with her torch. Close to the shore of Governor's Island, a large liner was beached. She must have been run aground at high tide, and now at low tide she loomed up far above the water, canted at a crazy angle. Secretly infected before leaving Europe, before long with passengers and crew alike, dead and dying, that ship must have made desperately for a port which itself had strangely ceased to send out signals. No tugs came out to meet her. Perhaps a dying bosun on the bridge lacked even the crew to drop an anchor, and with dimming eyes merely steered her toward the mud bank. There she would rest, and doubtless the waves would wash up mud against her obstructing bulk, and in a century she would be almost indistinguishable, the rust-covered center of a little island with trees growing up around her. Going on, Ish swung off through the east side, struck a noisome area again at the great center of Bellevue Hospital, turned west and found the same difficulty around Pennsylvania Station and the adjoining hotels, and finally went north on 11th Avenue. He turned into Riverside Drive and noticed that the sun was getting low over the smokeless smokestacks of the Jersey Shore. He was just wondering where he should spend the night when he heard a voice calling out. "Hi there!" Princess burst into a frenzy of barking. Stopping the car, he looked back and saw a man emerging from the entryway of an apartment house. Ish got out to meet him, leaving the barking princess in the car. The man advanced with outstretched hand. He was completely conventional-looking, well-shaved, wearing a tropical worsted suit, with even the coat on. He was middle-aged and overweight, with a smiling face. Ish half expected him to break into the conventional shopkeeper's greeting. "Well, sir, what can I do for you today?" "Abrams is the name," he said. "Milt Abrams." Ish fumbled for his own name. It was so long since he had thought of it. Introductions over, Milt Abrams took him inside. They went into a pleasant apartment on the second floor. A blonde-haired woman, about 40, well-dressed, almost smart-looking, was sitting at a cocktail table, and there was a cocktail shaker before her. "Meet the missus," said Milt Abrams, and from the way he hesitated, Ish knew that the missus merely covered up his embarrassment. The catastrophe would scarcely have spared a husband and wife. and there had been no opportunity for any ceremony since. Milt Abrams was obviously conventional enough to let this worry him, even under the circumstances. The missus looked at Ish with a smile, possibly at Milt's discomfort. "Call me Anne," she said, "and have a drink. Warm martinis, that's all I can offer you. Not a scrap of ice in New York City." In her own way, she was as typical a New Yorker as Milt. "I tell her," said Milt. "I keep on telling her not to drink that stuff. Warm martinis are poison." "Think of it," said Anne. "Spending a whole summer in New York City and without a scrap of ice." Nevertheless, she seemed to have overcome her dislike of warm martinis sufficiently to have got on the outside of several of them. "Here, I'll offer you something better," said Milt. Opening a cupboard, he displayed a fine shelf of Amontillado, Napoleon brandy, and selected liqueurs. "And," he added, "they don't call for ice." Obviously, Milt was a natural connoisseur in liquor. The bottle of Chateau Margaux that he produced for dinner was further proof. Chateau Margaux, over a meal of cold, canned corned beef, was not perhaps all that could be wished. But the wine was plentiful enough to produce in Ish a slight and happy befuddlement. Anne was definitely befuddled by this time. The evening passed pleasantly enough. They played cards by candlelight, three-handed bridge. They drank liqueurs. They listened to records on a tinny-toned portable phonograph, which had the great advantage of not needing electric power, but of being wound up by hand. They talked, as you might talk on any evening. "That record scratches. I haven't won a finesse yet. Let me have another glassful." It was a kind of make-believe. You pretended there was a world outside the windows. You were playing cards by candlelight because that was a pleasant thing to do. You did not trade reminiscences or talk of what you might think anyone would talk about under such circumstances. And Ish realized that this was proper and right. Normal people, and Milton Ann seemed to be certainly normal, did not concern themselves much with either the distant past or the distant future. Fortunately, they lived in the present. Yet, as the cards were dealt and played, by incidental remarks here and there, Ish put together a great deal of the situation. Milt had been part owner of a small jewelry store. Anne had been the wife of someone named Harry, and they had been prosperous enough to spend summers on the coast of Maine. The only work for pay that Anne had ever done had been to sell perfume in one of the more exclusive shops as a kind of lark during the Christmas rush. Now the two of them occupied a fine apartment, vastly better than even Harry had been able to provide. The electricity had failed immediately because the dynamos, which supplied New York, had been steam-driven. The water supply remained apparently abnormal, and this prevented any sanitary problem. Actually, they were marooned on Riverside Drive. Being ordinary New Yorkers, they had never owned a car, and so neither of them could drive. Automobiles were mysteries to them. Since all public transportation had now disappeared, they were left wholly afoot, and neither was of an age or temperament or physique to enjoy walking. Broadway, with its still well-stocked food and liquor stores, formed their practical eastern limit. The river lay to the west. They wandered up and down the drive, perhaps half a mile north and south. That was their world. Within these narrow limits, they did not think that anyone else was living. As to what might be happening in the rest of the city, they had not as much idea as Ish. To them, the east side was as far off as Philadelphia. Brooklyn might as well be Saudi Arabia. Once in a while, indeed, they had heard cars go by on Riverside Drive, and on rare occasions they had seen one. They had been wary, however, about approaching any of the cars, because, from loneliness and a sense of helplessness, a fear had come upon them, and they had a kind of bugaboo terror about roving gangsters. But everything was getting so quiet that I really wanted to see someone. You weren't driving fast, said Milt almost diffidently, and I saw you were alone and didn't look bad and had an out-of-town license. Ace started to say that he would give them his pistol, but checked himself. Firearms were as likely to create as to solve difficulties. In all probability, Milt had never fired a gun in his life, and he did not look like an apt learner. As for Anne, she gave the impression of being one of those excitable women who would be as dangerous to friend as to foe if she ever started cutting loose with a pistol. In spite of having no motion pictures and no radio, and in spite of lacking even that great and continual show of the passing populace of the city, still Milt and Anne did not seem to be particularly bored. They played cribbage, alternating with two-handed rummy, four high, but of course, mythical stakes. As the result, Anne now owed Milt several millions of dollars. They played endless records. Jazz, folk songs, dance tunes on the tinny phonograph. They read uncounted volumes of mystery stories, which they got from the circulating libraries on Broadway and left strewn around the apartment. Physically, he guessed they found each other attractive. But if they were not bored, neither did they seem to have much pleasure in life. There was a great vacantness somewhere. From shock, they were walking in a kind of haze. They were people without hope. New York, their world, had vanished. It would never live again in their time. They had no interest when Ish tried to tell them what had happened in the rest of the United States. Falls Rome, falls the world. Next morning, Anne was having another warm martini at breakfast and still complaining that there was not a scrap of ice in New York City. They urged him to stay longer. They urged him even to stay permanently. He could certainly find himself a girl somewhere in New York, they said. She would make a fourth for bridge. They were the pleasantest people he had found since the catastrophe, yet he had no desire to stay there with them, even if he could locate a girl for a fourth at bridge and other things. No, he decided. He would strike back for the West again. But as he drove off and they stood at the entryway of the apartment house and waved to him, he almost turned back to stay a while longer. He liked them, and he pitied them. He hated to think what would happen when winter struck, and the deep canyons between the buildings were clogged with snow and the north wind whistled down the groove of Broadway. There would be no central heating in New York City that winter, though indeed there would be plenty of ice, and no need to drink warm martinis. He doubted whether they could survive the winter, even though they piled broken furniture into the fireplace. Some accident would quite likely overtake them, or pneumonia might strike them down. They were like the highly bred spaniels and Pekingese who at the end of their leashes had once walked along the city streets. Milt and Anne, too, were city dwellers. And when the city died, they would hardly survive without it. They would pay the penalty which in the history of the world, he knew, had always been inflicted upon organisms which specialized too highly. Milt and Anne, the owner of a jewelry store, a sales girl for perfumes, they had specialized until they could no longer adapt themselves to new conditions. They were almost at the other end of the scale from those Negroes in Arkansas who had so easily gone back to the primitive way of living on the land. The drive curved, and he knew that they would now be out of his sight, even if he turned around. He felt the warmth and fullness of tears in his eyes. Goodbye, Milton Ann. Chapter 5. Headed west. Going home, as he still thought of it. He felt often as if he were on a leisurely camping trip. A man and his dog drove in a car, and the days slipped by uneventfully. He crossed the rich farmlands of eastern Pennsylvania, where the ripe, unharvested wheat was golden brown and the corn stood shoulder high. When he came to the empty turnpike, he stepped hard on the accelerator and steered deliriously around the neatly banked curves at 80 and 90 miles an hour, careless of danger, intoxicated with the mere joy of speed. He went on into Ohio. By now, gas pressure had failed almost everywhere, but he picked up a two-burner gasoline stove, which functioned perfectly. When the weather was fine, he merely camped in the woods and built himself a fire. Tinned goods, salvaged from stores, still remained the basis of his diet. But he foraged in the cornfields and took vegetables and fruit when he could find any. He would have enjoyed some eggs, but chickens seemed to have vanished completely. He saw no ducks either. Weasels, cats, and rats, he imagined, had cleaned out this smaller poultry, grown too stupid under long domestication to live without protection. Once, however, he heard the raucous call of guinea fowl, and twice he saw geese calmly floating in barnyard ponds. He shot one of them, but found he had had the bad luck to bag an old gander, too tough to be made palatable by any campfire cookery. He often saw turkeys in the woods and occasionally shot one. If Princess had been a bird dog, he might have tried for partridges and pheasants. And though she departed hot on the trail of innumerable rabbits, she never brought one back to within range of the shotgun. In the end, he began to wonder whether these always invisible rabbits might not be pure figments of her imagination. Cattle were common in the pastures, but he found the thought of the butchering too unpleasant and had no great hunger for meat in the hot weather. He saw occasional small flocks of sheep. When the road went through swampy country, he sometimes almost ran over hogs, which seemed to enjoy stretching out in the shade and the coolness of the deserted concrete pavement. Lean dogs still haunted the towns. He rarely saw cats, but he sometimes heard them at night, and so he judged that they had already returned to nocturnal habits. Avoiding the larger cities, he drove westward, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, through the fields of tall corn and all the empty little towns, sun-flooded and empty by day, dark and empty by night. Still, he looked for the small things that showed how the wilderness was moving in to take charge. The tiny sprout of a poplar tree standing up in the shaggy grass of a lawn, a telephone wire dangling on the road, the tracks of dried mud where a coon had paused to dip its food in the water of the fountain, beneath the statue of the Civil War soldier in front of the courthouse. He came upon people, now generally by twos or threes. The isolated molecules were beginning to find one another. Usually these people were clinging to some little spot that they had known previous to the disaster. As before, not one of them showed any desire to go away with him, but sometimes they invited him to stay. He found the offer no temptation. These people were physically alive, but more and more he realized that they walked about in a kind of emotional death. He had studied enough anthropology to realize that the same phenomenon had been observed on a smaller scale before. Destroy the culture pattern in which people lived, and often the shock was too great for the individuals. Take away family and job, friends and church, all customary amusements and routines, hope too, and life became walking death. The secondary kill was still at work. Once he saw a woman whose mind had failed. The clothes indicated an original prosperity, but now she was scarcely able to care for herself and could certainly not last through a winter. Several survivors told him of others who had committed suicide. As yet, though sometimes he wondered, he himself was conscious of no great strain, either of shock or of loneliness. He attributed this to his maintenance of interest in the whole progress of events, and to his own peculiar temperament. He thought many times of his qualifications for the new life, as he had once listed them. Sometimes, while he drove or sat by his fire, erotic images rose to his mind. He thought of Anne on Riverside Drive, crisp and well-groomed in her blondness. But she was an exception. The usual women were ill-kempt and even dirty, their faces blank with mental apathy, except when they laughed hysterically or giggled. Some of them were obviously approachable, but always he felt desire wither away within him. This, he realized, might be the particular form that shock took with him. But there was no need to force matters. In the end, he might change. All across the blazing plains of Nebraska, the wheat had not been harvested. Now it stood, losing its golden color, turning brown. The grains were already dropping from the heads. Next year, there would be a volunteer crop. But all around the edges, other kinds of grass would also sprout up, grass that could grow more readily when the soil was not disturbed. Soon, he knew these native grasses would form a sod and crowd out the wheat. Estes Park was restful after the heat of the plains. He stayed there for a week. The trout had not struck at a hook all summer, and the fishing was excellent. Next came the high mountains, and then the desert again and the sagebrush. Then he was pressing his foot hard and steering round the curves of US 40 toward the summit of Donner Pass. On the other side of the pass, he suddenly sensed that the country all ahead was palled in smoke. What month is it anyway, he thought. August? Early September, more likely. Bad forest fire season. And he remembered that now there would be no one to battle against the fires which lightning would still start. By Yuba Gap, he suddenly came to the fire. It was burning low on both sides of the road, and he chanced running through it. The highway was wide, and things were not too hot. Until, on rounding a curve, he came squarely upon a snag, fallen and blocking the way completely, blazing along its whole length, fierce with heat. Suddenly, he again felt the old fear which he had shaken off, years ago it seemed, that morning in the desert. The utter loneliness to face an emergency or recover from any accident. There was nothing for it but to turn the car around on the highway. He shuttled back and forth twice, killing the engine in his panicky haste. It started again, and he swung on the back trail out of the flames. Once more in safety, he recovered his calm. He drove back to the junction with California 20 and decided to make another try. There was some fire along this road, too, but generally it had swept past already. He drove carefully, avoiding a few chunks of fallen tree on the road, and managed to get through. He was appalled, however, as he gained the ridge beyond and saw fire seemingly everywhere. He was lucky to make it. He had planned to camp that night in the cool of the mountains. Instead, to escape being further blocked by fire, he drove on and unrolled his sleeping bag in the little park of a foothill town. No lights were burning. He was disappointed, for he had hoped to find lights in California. The forest fire, however, would undoubtedly have burned out the power lines, at least locally. As he lay trying to sleep, hot and uncomfortable, the dryness of smoke in his nostrils, he had the feeling that now he was trapped. Even though the fires would burn themselves out, the roads across the Sierra would be permanently blocked by many fallen trees and by landslides and washouts upon the denuded slopes. In the morning, as usual, he felt more cheerful. If he was trapped, California was a comfortably large place to be trapped in. And even though the Sierra would be impassable, the southern road through the desert might remain open for a long time. He was just ready to start, but Princess, with her usual perverseness, suddenly gave tongue and disappeared on a trail. Irritated, he waited for her, and when she did not return, he changed his plans and spent most of the day lolling, half-naked, in the shade of some trees. In the late afternoon, he started. At twilight, he came to the crest of the hill and looked out again over the broad expanse of all the Bay Cities. With a sudden start of pleasure, he saw that most of the street lights were still burning. There had been no electric lights for such a long time that he could really not remember where he had last seen them. All the steam-driven power plants must have failed almost immediately, and even the smaller hydroelectric systems had not lasted long. He felt a curious local pride mingling with his pleasure. Perhaps these were the last electric lights left burning in the whole world. At the moment, he could almost think that it had all been some wild vagary of the imagination, and that he had now returned to a normally functioning city. The long, empty highway ahead of him gave the lie to such thoughts. He looked more carefully. A few sections, he decided, had blacked out through local failure of power since he had been away. The lights on the Golden Gate Bridge were either extinguished, or else he could not see them because of the smoke drift upon the bay. He turned into San Lupo Drive. As far as he could see from the streetlights and the headlight glare, everything looked just the same as when he had last left it. There'll always be a San Lupo Drive, he thought. And then he realized that at least he was enough like all the other survivors to pick out some particular familiar spot, and though he went away, to return to it again like the homing pigeon. He opened the front door, snapped the lights on, and looked. Nothing was changed. He had known that it must be so, and yet there had always been hope. He felt no active sorrow, but only dullness. The sear and yellow leaf, he thought, saying a line he had heard on the stage but not knowing what play. There would have been a time. Princess made a sudden dash into the kitchen, slipped on the linoleum, skidded, yelped comically, and recovered. Thankful to her again for breaking the tension, he followed her. She was sniffing along the baseboard, but he failed to discover what had excited her. Well, he thought, walking back to the living room, if I have no feelings left. That is perhaps strange, but at least there is no one now to whom I can pretend. It is probably all part of what I am passing through. The note, which he had left posted on the desk, was still there, undisturbed, looking remarkably fresh. He took it, crumpled it, threw it into the fireplace, scratched a match. He hesitated a moment. Then he touched the match to the paper and watched the flame blaze up. That was finished. In that generation, there will be neither father, nor mother, nor wife, nor child, nor friend. But it will be as in the ancient tales, when the gods reared up a new people from stones or dragon's teeth, and they were all strangers with strange faces, and no man knew his fellow's face. The next morning he settled down to establish his life. Food, he knew already, was no problem at all. In the nearest business district, he began looking into store windows. Rats and mice were making a mess of everything, and the floors were littered with gnawed cartons and spilled food. Through one window, however, he was startled to see the gaily colored piles of fruit and vegetables as fresh and lovely as ever. He stared incredulously, peering through the dust-coated glass. Then, first with irritation and then with amusement, he realized that the bright colors were merely from the papier-mâché oranges, apples, tomatoes, and avocados which the store in the old days had used for a permanent front window display. After a while, he saw through the windows a grocery which was unlittered. Apparently, it must be rodent-proof. Carefully jimmying a window, he got into the store. The bread was inedible, and weevils were at work even in some of the carefully sealed boxes of crackers. But the dried fruit, and everything inside of tin and glass was as good as ever. As he was picking out some cans of olives, he heard an electric motor start. Curiously, he opened the refrigerator and found that the butter was still perfectly preserved. Next, he investigated the deep freeze units and found fresh meat, frozen vegetables, ice cream, and even materials for a green salad. When he left with his loot, he closed the window carefully behind him to keep at least that one store free of rats. After he had returned to the house, he reflected upon his position again and decided that as yet, the mere maintenance of life would be easy, indefinitely. Food, clothing. The shops were full, and he had only to help himself. Water still gushed from the faucets at full pressure. The gas had failed, and if it had been a country of bitterly cold winters, he might have had to consider laying in some kind of fuel supply. But his gasoline stove served excellently for cooking. If the fireplace was not sufficient in the winter, he could round up a battery of such stoves and supply himself with all the heat he needed. In fact, he soon began to feel so pleasantly self-sufficient that he feared he was turning into a hermit, like the old man he had once seen. In those days, when there had been death even in the air and civilization tottered toward its end, in those days, the men who controlled the flow of the water looked at one another and said, "Even though we fall sick and die, still, the people must have water." And they thought of plans that they had laid carefully in those times when men feared that bombs would fall. Then they set the valves and opened the channels, so that the water flowed freely all the way from the great dams in the mountains, and through the long siphons, and into the tunnels, and finally to the reservoirs from which it would flow, all at the pull of the earth, through all the faucets. "Now," they said, "when we are gone, the water will flow on, yes, until the pipes rust out. And that will be the time of a generation." Then they died. But they died as men who have finished their work and lie down quietly, secure in their honor. So at the end, there was still the blessing of water, and no one thirsted. And even when only a few wanderers walked through the city streets, the water still flowed. Ish had feared at first that he would suffer from mere boredom, but he soon found himself as busy as he wished to be. The desire for activity which had expressed itself in his eastern trip had now faded out. He slept a great deal. He also found himself sitting for long periods, conscious but in sheer apathy. Such lapses, however, frightened him, and he always tried to force himself into some kind of activity. Fortunately, though the mechanics of living were not complicated, they took up an appreciable part of his time. He had to prepare his food, and he soon found that unless he washed the dishes promptly, a stream of ants appeared to make everything twice as difficult. He was forced, for the same reason, to wrap up the garbage and carry it somewhere away from the house. He had to feed Princess. Since she was getting smelly, he even bathed her over her loud protests. One day, wanting to shake himself out of his apathy, he went to the public library, smashed a lock with his hammer, and after some browsing, found himself, a little to his own amusement, walking out with Robinson Crusoe and the Swiss Family Robinson. These books, however, did not interest him greatly. Crusoe's religious preoccupations seemed boring and rather silly. As for the Robinsons, he felt, as he had felt when a boy, that the ship remained for the family a kind of infinite grab bag from which at any time they might take exactly what they wanted. Although the radio was dead, he still had the family's record player and collection of records. After a while, he located in a music store a better record player. It was heavy, but he was just able to get it home on the station wagon tailgate, and set it up in the living room. He also took all the records he wanted. Feeling the need of something more, too, he helped himself to a fine accordion. With the aid of an instruction book, he managed to make some very soul-satisfying noises on it, although Princess objected at times with loud howls. He also supplied himself with drawing materials, but never got round to using them. His chief interest remained the careful observation of what was happening to the world after the removal of man's controls. He drove around through all parts of the city and into the nearby country. At other times, carrying his field glasses, he took long walks through the hills, with Princess trailing now behind him, and now dashing off in wild pursuit of that perpetual unseen rabbit. Once he searched for the old man, whom he had found storing up all the supplies of miscellaneous goods. After some trouble, he located the house and found the rat's nest of materials which had been piled in it. But the old man was not in the house, and there was no evidence as to where he had gone or whether he was still alive. Aside from this, Ish made no effort to find people, remembering how unsatisfactory had been the results of his previous attempts. The look of the streets was changing a little. The drought of summer had not yet been broken, but the winds had blown dust and leaves and trash and deposited them in little piles here and there. Over most of the city he saw no animals at all, neither dogs nor cats nor rats. In certain areas, however, particularly near the waterfront, he saw a good many dogs, although only of a certain kind. They were small and active ones, terriers, or terrier-like mongrels. By watching, he saw that they marked the establishment of some new cycle of life. They scavenged in the supplies which they found in the stores, perhaps having learned this from the rats. Where the rats gnawed open a carton of crackers, the dogs came in and ate. But also the dogs apparently lived largely upon the rats. This accounted for their concentration in the areas where rats had been somewhat abundant even before the catastrophe. The dogs had also apparently driven away or killed off the cats, doubtless getting scratched in the process, but also achieving some desperately needed meals. These dogs amused Ish. They seemed almost to swagger, cocky still, as terriers were supposed to be. Though dirty and thin, they exuded vigor and self-confidence, as if knowing that they had solved the problem of life. Temperamentally, they must represent the individuals who had always lived more or less on their own, taking care of themselves as they wished and paying scant attention to men. They showed no interest in Ish, keeping distance, not trying either to make friends or to escape from him. After Princess had tangled in a rough-and-tumble fight with one of the bitches, he took the precaution of keeping her on a leash or in the car whenever he drove through such districts. In parks and on the edges of the city, wherever there was a good growth of bushes, he occasionally saw a cat. They kept mostly to the branches, apparently fearing the dogs and, at the same time, ready to prey upon birds. During his walks in the hills, he had never seen any dogs until one day he was surprised to hear a medley of yaps and deeper bays. Gaining a point from which he could look out, he saw a half-dozen cattle on what had once been the golf course, closely pursued and being harried by some 8 or 10 dogs. Focusing the field glasses, he saw that the dogs were of different varieties, but none of them of the short-legged ratter type. There was a magnificent Dane, a collie, a spotted Dalmatian, and others which had more the mongrel look, but were all long of leg and moderately powerful. They were obviously a hunting pack, spontaneously formed and already experienced at their business. They were trying to cut out one of the calves, but the cattle fought back, vigorously, horns toward the pack or kicking out from behind. They gradually made their way out of the open stretches of grass. When they reached the shelter of some bushes at the edge of the golf course, they seemed to gain the advantage, and the dogs drew off. Since the show was over, Ish called Princess, and they started to walk back a mile toward where he had left the car. In a few minutes, he heard the bay of the pack again. It came closer, and suddenly he knew that they were on his own trail. Panic struck at him. He started to run, but after a few yards, he realized that running would be of no use and only an invitation. He stilled his panic, gathered up a few stones, and selected a fallen branch to serve for a club. He continued to walk toward the car. The baying came closer. Then suddenly it stopped, and he knew that the dogs must have sighted him. He hoped that the long-ingrained respect for mankind had survived, but also he suddenly began to wonder what had happened to the old man and the other people whom he had once seen in this region. Now, one of the dogs, an ugly black mongrel, came out on the road right in front of him. 50 yards off, it stopped, sat down, and looked at him. As he drew closer, he raised his arm and made a gesture of throwing a stone. By age-old reaction, the dog jumped up. It loped to the side of the road and disappeared into the bushes. Ish could hear movement elsewhere in the brush, as if the dogs were circling about. Princess was behaving in her usual irritating and uncertain fashion. Now she cringed, tail between legs, brushing against him. Again she made short provocative dashes with loud barks, this direction and that, as if challenging one and all to combat with her and her man. Now he could see the car far ahead. He walked steadily, husbanding his stones, looking backward only now and then, depending upon Princess to give warning if a sudden attack should come from behind. He caught a glimpse of the Dane standing in a gap between bushes, a magnificent dog, heavy as a man. With a loud yap, Princess made a suicidal dash at the great beast. He sprang toward her, and at the same time, the collie dashed out of the bushes on the left. But Princess doubled with the agility of a rabbit, and the two larger dogs collided in their rush and caromed off each other, snarling. Princess came back again to brush against his legs, her tail drooping. Now the Dalmatian crossed into the road ahead and stood there, red tongue lolling out. Ish continued his steady pace. The Dalmatian was the least fierce-looking of the dogs, and Ish felt that he might brave that one. A handsome collar still circled the spotted neck, a metal dog tag dangling from it. Uneasily, Ish saw that it was thin with ribs showing, and yet did not look in too bad condition. Evidently on rabbits or calves or on whatever the pack might run down or find as carrion, the dogs were managing to get along. He hoped that they had not yet been driven into cannibalism, and that their interest in Princess might be somewhat playful, not to mention their interest in a stray man. At 20 feet distance, without slacking a steady pace, Ish raised his arm, threatening. The Dalmatian suddenly dropped tail between legs and slunk off. The car was close now, and Ish relaxed. He got to the car, opened the door for Princess to jump in, and stilling a last-moment panicky impulse to scramble, he himself stepped in behind her with dignity. As the door clicked shut, he had an immediate feeling of safety. He let his hand close comfortably around the solid handle of the hammer which lay at his feet. He felt sick with the reaction. Looking out from the car, he saw only the handsome Dalmatian sitting at the side of the road. Now being safe, Ish felt his attitude quickly changing. Actually, the dogs had done him no harm, and indeed had not really even threatened him. During a few minutes, he had thought of them as wild creatures thirsting for his blood. Now, they seemed a little pitiful, as if they might merely have been seeking the companionship of a man because of what they remembered long ago. Of food laid out in dishes, of crackling logs in the fireplace, of a patting hand and a soothing voice. As he drove away, He wished them no bad luck, but rather hoped that they would manage occasionally to snap up a rabbit or pull down a calf. The next morning, the whole matter had even a more comic aspect when he became aware of Princess's changed condition. Not wanting any puppies, he shut her in the basement. Yet, he could not be sure, and he decided if there was one way rather than another by which he did not care to die, it was to be torn to pieces by the teeth of dogs. After that, he made it a rule always to walk on the hills with a pistol strapped at his belt, or else with his rifle or shotgun. 2 days later, the problem of dogs had come to seem a petty one compared with the problem of ants. They had already troubled him, but now they seemed to arrive from all directions at once and to cover everything. Even in the old days, he could remember that constant battle. His mother's cry of dismay at finding a line of them in the kitchen, his father's irritation, and the constant debate about whether they should summon the Ant-Man or try to handle the situation themselves. But now the ants were 100 times worse than ever before. No longer did ardent householders combat them in the houses and even wage offensive war against them in their own strongholds. Now, after a few months, their powers of rapid breeding had brought their numbers to climactic proportions. Probably also they had found great supplies of food somewhere. They streamed everywhere. Ish was sorry enough not to be a good enough entomologist to ascertain what really was happening and to work out the history of this overpowering increase. But in spite of some investigations, he never even discovered for certain whether the ants were spreading outward from some great center of development or whether they were breeding equally all over the city. Their scouts ranged everywhere. Suddenly, he had to become a furiously meticulous housekeeper, for the slightest scrap of food, or even a dead fly, brought an immediate stream of ants an inch wide, overwhelming the insignificant prey which had attracted them. He found them wandering upon Princess's coat like fleas, although apparently they did not bite. He found them in his own clothes. Once in the early morning, he awoke with a horrible dream because a stream of ants was pouring across his own cheek, bent to some goal which he never discovered. Actually, the house was only alien ground into which they made raids. Their real strength lay outside. Their hills seemed now to be everywhere. He could not overturn a clod without having ants swarm out by thousands from burrows that pierced the earth. They must be annihilating all the other insects, he thought, destroying their means of subsistence, even if not killing them. He got bottles of ant poison and DDT spray from the drugstore and tried to make the house into a hostile island, but the pressure of numbers was so great from the outside that they streamed across his spray. Doubtless all the trespassers inevitably died, but the death of even millions of individuals would not affect such numbers appreciably. He tried to estimate how many ants must be living on this one city lot, but he came out with an unbelievable answer in billions. Had they no natural enemies? Had they broken all limits of control? With the removal of man, were they now destined to inherit the earth? Yet, after all, they were only the little hustling ants which had irritated and plagued California housewives. Making some investigations, he found that actually the range of the plague did not extend appreciably beyond the limits of the city. In some way, like dogs and cats and rats, these ants had come to be domestic animals, dependent upon the activities of man. This gave him a certain hope. If he had only been seeking his ease, he would have left the city. But he preferred, even at the cost of some discomfort, to watch what was happening. Then one morning he realized suddenly that he had not noticed any ants. He looked around carefully, but he could not see any of their scouts. He dropped a bit of food on the floor, then went away about some other business for a few minutes. When he returned to the scene of his experiment, the food lay there without an ant upon it. Curious, Realizing that something had happened, he went outside. He turned over a clod of dirt, and no ants swarmed from their holes. He hunted carefully. Here and there, he discovered a few stragglers wandering about aimlessly, but they were so few that he could have counted them individually. He hunted still further. He could find no dead bodies of ants. They had simply vanished. Perhaps, if he had had the skill in their ways to dig down and find their nests, he would have discovered that they were lying dead in their billions. But again, he could only wish that he knew more of their manner of life and could carry on an investigation. He never solved the mystery, but he had little doubt as to what had happened. When any creature reached such climactic numbers and attained such high concentration, a nemesis was likely to fall upon it. Possibly the ants had exhausted the supplies of food which had led to this tremendous increase of numbers. More likely, some disease had fallen upon them and wiped them out. In the next few days, he smelled, or thought he smelled, a faint, all-pervading putrescence, as if from the decaying bodies of billions of ants. One evening, shortly afterward, he sat reading and after a while began to feel hungry. He went to the kitchen and rummaged in the refrigerator for some cheese. Happening to glance at the electric clock, he was surprised to see that the time was only 9:37. He had thought it was later. On his way back to the living room, he took a bite of the cheese and glanced at his wristwatch. The watch hand stood at 10:09, and he knew that he had set the watch by the clock within 24 hours. The old clock's going to pieces at last, he thought. Not surprising. He remembered how the motion of its hands had startled him when he had first returned to the house. He sat down to read again. A high wind from the north with the heavy smell of smoke in it blew so hard that it rattled the windows occasionally. By now he was used to the smell of smoke and did not think about it. At many times he could not even get a good view because of the smoke of the burning forests. After a while he blinked his eyes a little and stared more intently at the page where the letters seemed to have grown strangely indistinct. The smoke must be making my eyes water, he thought. I don't seem to see so well. But as he looked closer, it seemed that not only the page before him, but the whole room had grown dimmer. With a sudden start, he looked at the electric light bulb in the bridge lamp beside him. Then quickly, with a jumping heart, he was out of his chair and standing on the front porch, looking out over the broad stretches of the city below him. The lights were still burning along the streets. The chains of yellow beads still showed on the great bridge, and at the tops of the towers, the red lights were flashing. He looked more carefully. The lights seemed a little dimmer than they should be, but he could be imagining that, or they might be obscured by all the drifting smoke. He went back and sat in his chair again and tried to read, forgetting about it, forgetting what he feared. But he blinked and, again, looking at the light beside him, he was puzzled. Then suddenly he remembered the clock. Well, he thought, it had to come. His watch now showed 10:52. He went out to the kitchen and saw that the clock was at 10:14. He calculated apprehensively. The result was bad. As closely as he could remember, the clock had lost 6 minutes in about 3/4 of an hour. The clock was run, he knew, by electrical impulses, which were ordinarily timed at 60 to the minute. Now they must be coming less often. An electrical engineer would doubtless have found it an elementary matter to calculate just how much less often. Ish could even have made an attempt at the calculation.